you're already on the line. You're on the Chicago Teachers Union's live telephone town hall. Dialing is still going on, and so we're going to start the call in just a moment. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Chicago Teachers Union's live telephone town hall. I'm Jesse Sharkey, president of CTU, and tonight we're going to be discussing the upcoming contract campaign, answering questions about what's going on in the charter sector, also talking about our legislative agenda, discussing how we're going to win our contract demands, and really generally talking about people's questions and concerns about what's going on at CTU right now. We're going to be, and of course, most importantly of all, we're going to be taking your questions. And so if at any time during the call you have a question, something you want to ask, you will dial 9, and you'll be connected to an operator who will let you, who will take your information so that you can get on the queue for questions. If for any chance during the course of tonight's call you get kicked off, you should have received an email with a call-in number, or you can dial 855-866-6311 to get back on the call. Again, 855-866-6311 if technology happens. Welcome to the call tonight. Again, this is the CTU's live telephone town hall, and we're lucky enough to be joined by a bunch of our members here who can help with questions and help explain what's going on right now. So we're gonna start to my right with Vice President Stacey Davis.
Good evening. Happy to be on the teletown hall with so many of our wonderful members. Looking forward to a lively discussion.
Good evening. I'm Andrea Parker, Chicago Teachers Union Communications Committee Chair and middle school teacher. Thank you for calling.
Good evening. I'm Annette Rizzo, Health and Benefits Coordinator and Field Rep.
Good evening. My name is LaShawn Wallace. I'm a PSIP teacher assistant.
Hello, this is Lillian Cass. I'm a special education teacher.
So we've got a room with some real expertise in it. As we go along tonight, we certainly will be able to answer questions and have a informative discussion. And I want to remind you, if at any point during the call you want to ask a question, please dial 9 to be connected to one of our operators who are standing by. And I just want to begin, I think, by talking a little bit about the CTU contract with the Chicago Board of Education. As many people on this call will know, that contract expires at the end of June. And it's important because the CTU-CPS contract controls many of the most important features of our job life, the terms and conditions of our work. We have been involved in a very long, involved rank-and-file process to come up with a set of bargaining demands. That really started about a year ago when we started surveying our membership, and we got CTU's many rank and file committees involved in trying to come up with ideas about what we wanted to see improvements on during this contract. So, for example, everything from our early childhood committee, our special education committee, all the way through to our high school committee, and everything in between all participated in trying to put forward ideas about what our demands should be. We also have a large group of rank and file members then took a look at those 400 or so demands that came in, and then compiled that into a document which the Chicago Teachers Union's House of Delegates ultimately reviewed and approved. If people want to take a look at that document, it's about 50 pages long. We're not going to go through the whole thing, but it's up on the behind the member portal on the CTU's website. But really, our demands fall in 4 main buckets. The first one is that we're demanding fair wages and benefits. We think that we need to see a considerable increase in our pay. We think that our health insurance needs improvements and needs to be cheaper. And we have some other demands around benefits. So, for example, we think that we should be able to retain the ability or regain the ability to bank our sick days if we don't use them. We're asking for 5% of your raise, and we're also asking, and it's not a lot of money in the second demand, we're asking for the steps to be extended all the way to 25, so that rather than, when you get to that 14th year, rather than seeing your earning potential sort of flatten off, we're saying that we should continue receiving steps all the way through to the 25th year the way they do in the suburbs. So that's pay and benefits. The second thing, sort of a critical concern, is that we want to address our working conditions by addressing our critical staffing shortages. We think that CPS is running a bare-bones school system right now. There just aren't enough adults in the buildings. So the second thing we really have to address in this contract is CPS has to hire. We're talking about case managers in our buildings. We're talking about social workers to address student social and emotional needs. We're talking about librarians. We're talking about a nurse in every school every day. We need PSRPs, to help do duties and supervise students and also help teachers in classrooms. And then an area after area, and I won't be able to hit all of them now, but really there needs to be some substantial hiring in our schools. Third thing that's a concern, the third area is really we're asking for smaller class sizes. Across the board, we need the board to address the fact that our class sizes are just too large. I've been in Kent schools this year where we have a school with a 41-student kindergarten. It's completely unacceptable. Many schools have kindergartens of 31 or 32. We want to target the lower grades especially. Research shows that makes a critical difference. But we want to see reductions at all levels, and we want the class sizes in our contract to be enforceable. So that's the third area. The fourth area of our demands have to do with demands that are both good for our schools and the surrounding communities. So we're talking about justice for our schools and their communities. So for example, many of our schools serve immigrant populations. We have demands about sanctuary provisions so that our immigrant students feel safe and are welcomed at our school. We have demands about sustainable community schools. We think that CPS needs to actually invest in schools that are in neighborhoods that help keep the neighborhood vital and keep us from continuing to lose population. Finally, in this area, we talk about housing, and we know that it's incredibly difficult to afford a house in Chicago. If you're a teacher, it's difficult. Places like Denver and San Francisco have programs that help teachers with that. But it's also difficult to afford housing if you're a parent. And the loss of our student population as housing prices skyrocket makes it very difficult for us to try to keep our schools open and our enrollments up. So those are the four areas. Fair wages and benefits, address working conditions to critical staffing needs, decrease class sizes, and win justice for our schools and their surrounding communities. I'm going to talk a little bit about how things have been going in this regard. I'm going to ask Stacy to come in on that. But remember, if at any time during this call you have a question, please dial 9 and you'll get connected to an operator, and then you'll be able to continue to listen to the call and hopefully get your question on. So Stacy, maybe you can take people through a little bit about how things have been going.
Look, this has been a monumental year for the Chicago Teachers Union. We've gone through three industry-changing strikes in the charter industry where our members in the charter sector have been able to win real gains in classroom benefits, resources to their classrooms, and increases in pay and benefits. Those are things that will certainly help the infrastructure of our fight with the Chicago Public Schools. Beyond that, we can't say enough about the manifestation of the SPED fight from last year and how having the monitor this year has been a direct line of communication for many of our educators who have been frustrated for a long time about the lack of support that the district offers. Beyond that, look, we still have two ongoing federal civil rights lawsuits, that have, because of the displacement of black women, veteran educators in the Chicago Public Schools, AUSL used to come into our buildings and basically fire everyone, and they came into buildings mainly on the south and west sides of the city. And we're pleased to report that since 2014, that has been on the decline. And it's been in the decline because you all have pushed back against the status quo and fought against the encroachment of privatization in all forms.
Thank you. Those are important points. I do think that when we think about the prospects of winning the things that we're talking about here, it's important to note that we weathered a storm, and now ROM and Rauner are both out. and there's more money in the budget in large part because of the demands that our members made to restore school funding. And you look around this country and there are teachers and community members on the march from West Virginia to Arizona, you know, all the way to LA and back. And so, look, this is something which I know that we can win fair contract demands. This is going to be something which, if we mass up and act like a union, we've got a real possibility of improving conditions in our schools and improving our pay. One of the things that's going to be important to that is our ability to show our unity and our strength. And that's going to be something which we're going to ask people to come out on May 22nd. Are the first big contract rally that we're going to do to let the public know about our fight, to let people know about our seriousness about our demands, and also, honestly, to put pressure on the newly who will then be the newly inaugurated mayor, who will be inaugurated on the 20th. So on the 22nd, we're having a big rally at 5 p.m. at the Thompson Center, and we definitely want people out there for that. So. That's the basic picture, and I think now we should probably like try to go to some questions and hear a little bit about what's on people's minds. By the way, if at any point during this call you have a question, please dial 9. That'll get you connected up to an operator. So we're gonna go to the phone lines. We're gonna start with Andrew, and I believe Andrew has a question about sick days and the way those benefits work. So, Andrew, are you there on the line? Can you hear us?
Yes. My question is, the retirees prior to the 2012 contract used to get unlimited sick days bought back when they retired, and for some reason we got rid of that, basically. And I was wondering if we're trying to get at least some of those sick days back, because that's a lot of money for retirees.
Yeah. Thank you for the question. So the answer to that is yes. It is one of our bargaining demands. If you recall, we used to have the ability to bank unused sick days and then have the sick days paid out at the end of our careers. How much of them got paid out depended on how long you've been with the board. The problem with what the board is doing now is that people use their sick days rather than lose them. And, of course, that's one of the things that's leading to a problem that we're having with school coverage, where it's difficult to have, where a lot of times we don't have enough teachers or subs in the classrooms. And that you had something you want to add?
Andrew, the payout of sick days wasn't taken from you. It was given in exchange for. So in our contract, we were able to get short-term disability, which is a 90-day payout of sick days when you're truly sick. We have to follow federal guidelines when anybody goes on a medical leave, and we were restricted. And because we didn't have an extended leave that was paid, we found teachers having babies back-to-back were forced to resign. Cancer patients that returned and tried to work and had to leave again were forced to resign. So we picked up a 90-day paid policy, which actually was a pretty expensive per person charge, but we were able to negotiate that into our health care without any increase in premium, and we actually, the members didn't have to pay for that. So in exchange for that, we changed the way we received a payout of our sick days. In addition to that, when we were presented with the data before us, for years you can only get a payout of sick days if you have 20 years of service or more. We saw the data presented to us at the time showed that over 55% of our membership was young, and it also showed us that the attrition rate for those young people was 5 years. So we were finding that majority of the teachers coming into the system weren't going to even be around to pick up the payout. So in looking at all data presented to us, we felt the majority of teachers, the truly sick teachers, the teachers that were having babies, that they benefited from the 90-day sick leave than the payout of sick days, because it would take you 9 years to never be absent at 10 days a year.
Well, thank you for that explanation, Matt. But the bottom line is that the ability to bank sick days is something that we want back, and it's a key demand. And it's really the inability to do that is leading to a problem in our schools. So we're now going to go to Dennis. Dennis, I believe, is a school nurse who has a question about restoring or getting nurses in every school. Dennis, you're on the line. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Dennis, go ahead. You're on the line.
Okay.
Please ask your question.
Yeah. I'm really glad that the CTU is taking up this issue, and my question is basically, what can we do across the union to help raise this demand and get it out more? It's definitely a huge issue. My first year in CPS had 3 schools. My second year I had 5. This year I started the year with 6. Most of not all nursing services are done through agencies that CPS pays out millions of dollars to. They don't even provide benefits. At one of the schools that was at this year, the agency nurse had to quit because they didn't provide any health care. And so then that means that everyone else is scrambling to make up the work that they can no longer do. And so I guess, again, I'm really supportive of this bargaining demand. I'd just like to know more about how we can raise it across the district and let parents and teachers and the community know that this is something that we're fighting for.
Thanks for your question. What do we do to raise the demand about nurses? I mean, well, first, people here need to know that this is one of the areas where we have massive public support. The idea that you don't have a school nurse in a school every day just doesn't make sense to anybody. It's terrible. It's a terrible policy. CPS has adopted that policy because they're worried about like having nursing shortages. But in a lot of ways, the shortages are being driven by their attempt to try to privatize out nursing services and by poor conditions in schools. And so this is definitely something which we need to push for. And when we do that in public, I'm sure that we're going to get broad support. This is also one of the key strike issues in Los Angeles when LA teachers struck. And so that's something which we believe can be popular. And people should also know that it's something which Mayor-elect Lori Lightfoot promised in her campaign, to have a nurse in school every day. The thing which I will say, though, is that like many politicians promise things and think better of it when they get in office, because the reality of this is that it's an expensive demand. For every 10 staff is a $1 million a year. And so, you know, we currently have about 120 nurses or so for 550 schools. So if we want to add 430 more nurses, that is $43 million a year demand. And so it's like this gets back to the question of how do we win money out of the board? And in our opinion, the way we win that is, first of all, we have to have broad political support. Politicians have to feel pressure. We know they have the money. CPS's budget has improved, and they also just gave $1.6 billion to Lincoln Yards in the 78 as a tax giveaway to Sterling Bay developers. So the money is there for things that are the priorities. In order to make it a priority, they have to see hundreds and thousands of people on the streets. They have to know that this is a real priority for us. This is something that we're serious about. That's why we're talking about a rally. That's why we're talking about campaigning behind these contract demands.
Right, Jesse. You asked, how could you help? You can start organizing your parents, start showing up to LSC meetings, start showing up to board meetings, demanding that the board, if you have parents, a lot of times they think that because we work for CPS, we're just out for, you know, higher pay or whatever. But when parents ask for these things, then they seem to listen. Board meetings, organizing, and your LSC, and showing up on the 22nd downtown.
Thank you, Sean, and that's the mighty Sean Wallace for people who are wondering. let's go to another question. Okay, once again, Emily. Are you there, Emily?
Oh, hi. Yeah, I'm here. I have a question. About the fourth point, the campaign for, or the demand for social, how would you title that? Social justice and fair housing? Would I be saying that right on the fourth point?
School community demand. Yeah, think of it as
okay, so how
community.
Would that look like in a, yeah, the school and community. So I totally am with and understand why that would be, that's a very, you know, important campaign for us, but how does that look like in a contract? Like, you know, that I'm thinking of how could we file a grievance if there's not fair housing for parents or fair housing for, you know what I'm saying? Like, what does that look like in a contract?
Yeah, good. Thank you for the question. That's a great question. Different parts of this are different. For example, one of the demands that I mentioned there was about sustainable community schools. And actually, sustainable community schools is something that we won in the last contract, funding for 20 schools. And what that says is that there's a mechanism by which CPS distributes $500,000 of funding to 20 schools that are working with community partners that have parent, student, neighbor involvement, along, of course, with our members' involvement. And so that's a proven program. We'd like to see that expanded. That's a way that we think we can support neighborhood education. We want to see that expanded to 75 schools. So that's the way something like that would be incorporated in a contract. I talked about sanctuary language. Well, sanctuary language is something which we have draft language. We've seen that incorporated in Los Angeles. It has to do with a series of protocols and rules that the board would use for dealing with students in terms of their immigration status. And we also have seen that in terms of the charter contracts. So for example, in many of the charter contracts which we just negotiated, we actually saw that language put into place. Now, you specifically asked about housing. And so in this one, there's a couple of things, which is that the language about housing, so for example, subsidies for our members, many of whom also can't afford housing, we would take a look at language like they have in San Francisco or Denver, where there are some subsidies for members to help them afford housing. In terms of the broader community affordable housing, it's true that's actually something that we don't negotiate in our contract for broad community housing. It just turns out that there is $1 billion sitting in CHA's housing funds, which the CHA isn't spending. And so, we're in negotiations. Our negotiations are political. That's something which we'd raise as a demand. Do we have the ability to strike over, housing for, in the communities? Not necessarily, no, but it's something which I feel like we should try to provide some political and moral leadership on. I don't know if there's anyone else who wants to add to that. Okay, let's now go. Next, I think we have Joseph. Joseph, you have a question for us? Are you there?
Hi, yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Wait, loud and clear. Go ahead, you have a question.
Yes, so I was wondering, I think my understanding is the new mayor has mentioned that she doesn't want to rush into a new contract, and I was wondering what would our feelings be about extending the contract we have for another year while we give her time to sort of think things through. Is that something we would consider?
Do you feel the tomatoes coming at you through the telephone? Because I see them very clearly. But all jokes aside, Joseph, we are actually bound by state law to keep a particular type of schedule. Way back in 2011, Rahm Emanuel got through some pretty draconian legislation that provides a very tight timeline for how we engage in negotiations. And there was a timeline, an agreed-upon timeline, signed with the Board of Education to keep these going. Our intention is not, and I want to underscore that, not to put our members in a position to go without a contract for a year.
Right.
We actually feel very good about our contract demands because they mirror, quite frankly, a lot of what the mayor-elect ran off of. So if you put our contract demands up, and you look at her education platform, you will basically find a mirror there. We think this should be simple, to be perfectly honest with you, that we believe we need nurses in every school. She says we need nurses in every school. We believe we need to sustain the community schools that we got from the last contract and grow them. She believes the same thing as well. There were multiple things that made her a winning candidate, and I would say that when Chicago voted for change, they voted for a change in the relationship that the mayor-elect has with the Chicago Teachers Union as well. And so we look forward to a contract negotiation that will reflect best practices for our educators, smaller class sizes, better staffing ratios, and basic infrastructure that provides equity across the city.
Yeah, I'm going to add one thing to that, or actually two. One is just Stacey's point, which is that the last time we tried to do that, they screwed us. That is, they stopped enforcing our contract. They didn't recognize our lanes or steps. They ultimately imposed furloughs. And so that was a bad experience. I want a contract in place for next year. And the second thing is that we think we're in the late stages of an economic boom. And I'm happier to be negotiating a contract when their coffers are full and tax receipts look good than I would be in a year's time when the bottom's falling out of the economy and they can go back to us about crying poor. So, that's a very good question. We're going to go next to Adebisi. Adebisi, you're on the line. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I had a question. It's buzzing around the schools at this point that you guys are saying that we need to brace ourselves possibly for a strike. How true is that? Like, if you can give me a percentage point out of 100%, how true is that we should be bracing ourselves for a strike in the fall?
Let me be clear about this. Jesse has been clear over and over again, especially in house meetings with our delegates, that it's always what we plan for as teachers. And he echoes Karen Lewis in that way. Karen Lewis taught us two things. She taught us to look around corners, and she taught us to be good teachers and prepare for the worst and work for the best. And so when you're in a contract year and the contract expires on June 30th, between June 30th and the first day of school, only two things can happen. We can settle a great contract and vote on it, or we will not settle a contract and go on strike. So that's a 50-50 chance there. Now, we are going to put our best foot forward and negotiate in good faith and get something that reflects best practices, kind of like what I said before. And there's always the possibility that that won't happen. And because that's a possibility, we would be irresponsible to not tell you to prepare for the worst.
Yeah. And I just also want to say that we, the leadership at CTU, does not make a decision to strike. That is something that we all do as educators, CTU members. We have to say so. So it's not that Jesse or Stacy or the leadership makes the final call. We make the final call. So you talk to your delegate. Your delegate is supposed to vote how the members at your school feel. So you have to ask yourself, is this contract worth fighting for? So that's something you have to discuss within your school, and that's something that's also voted for. So this is a democratic process. So we do not make these decisions. Leadership does not make those decisions. We do as teachers.
Right. And what would likely happen is that we would come back into school next fall. We will have been bargaining over the summer.
Yes.
Hopefully we have something that looks like a final offer from the Board of Ed, and we're going to share that with the membership.
Yes.
And if that offer looks good to the members, if it looks like it's something which delivers the promises that Mayor Luck Lightfoot has made, if it looks like it's a raise of dignity and respect, then we can vote yes for that. If it doesn't, people want to reject it, then we're going to have a decision to make, which is our membership, 75%, that's the law, would have to vote in favor of authorizing a strike in order for us to consider striking at that point. But again, that will be something we do after we come back, after we've read and looked at the offers, after we get a couple paychecks under our belts, and something that we would have to do together. But it's a good question. But I now want to get into, I want to ask you guys a question, which is that, and this is going to be in the form of a poll, which you can take right on your phone, which is that on May 22nd, we are conducting a Keep the Promise for a Fair Contract rally. And we've talked about how this is important as a way to show our strengths, the city, as a way to elevate our demands and to underscore the popularity of our demands to the whole public, but also to the mayor who will just have been sworn in. So the question is, on May 22nd, the Keep the Promise Fair Contract rally, will you be coming to that? You yourself, can you make a commitment right now to come to that rally? Press 1 on your phone right now if you're coming, and press 2 if you can't make it. If you don't know yet, press 3. So 1 if you're coming, 2 if you know you can't, and 3 if you haven't decided yet. and we'll go ahead and we'll let those results come in. Remember, even if you can't come, you know, you should be encouraging your colleagues who can come to show up and go. So, okay, well, those results are coming in. I think we'll try to go to another question. We're going to take Janine, who should be still on the line. Janine's not on the line, okay? We're going to go down to Glenda. Glenda, if you're still on there, you're on the line. Can you you have a question? Glenda?
Oh, yes.
Hi, Glenda. Go ahead. You have a question.
Hi. What I want to know is why is there a lack of... Can you hear me?
Yeah. Loud and clear.
Okay. Why is there a lack of librarians in the system today? And why... Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Why is there a lack of librarians in the system today? And why do they? And why are the librarians that we see seem to be systematically being let go?
So this past Saturday, we had the culmination of our first policy fellowship, and one of our policy fellows, who's a special education teacher on the South Side, her action research project was to explore just the very question that you posed. And her conclusion came down to two things. The one big thing is Rahm Emanuel, and the second thing is school-based budgeting. In fact, what she discovered through her research is that there was a precipitous decline in librarians during his tenure in the last 8 years. Juxtaposed to that, she said that school-based budgeting was the vehicle in which was used to make that happen. So when we talk about school-based budgeting has to not be a part of how CPS proceeds, that particular policy has real-life impact on our students. In her research project, she also said that the one thing that will help to boost the achievement levels of students, especially students that attend schools on the South and West Side, is actually to have a library and a librarian. And so that is something that we've obviously popularized, you know, over time, and we'll continue to work towards. But let's be clear, school-based budgeting has been the enemy of not just librarians and libraries, they've been the enemies of veteran teachers,
yes.
They've been the enemies of a number of things. I just lost my thought, I'm sorry. But school-based budgeting is the single one thing in school communities across the city that have damaged the very curriculum and program that helps achievement in our school communities. This is something that will take political pressure, quite frankly, to ameliorate. Rahm created this in an effect to further marginalize our neighborhood schools and provide our charter operators with a better opportunity for success. Now, we know that organizing the members in those charters, we know that those members then declaring strikes, three of them so far, have been very successful and narrowing that gap and making sure that charters teachers have parity and that their students have resources, but it's also made them look very unattractive for expansion and proliferation as well. So in short, student-based budgeting is a vestige of Rahm Emanuel. This is something that will take political pressure to rid our school communities of and to replace with something that looks more like our new school funding formula, which looks a lot like the schools Chicago students deserve.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And, you know, as you know, we have a contract demand. Does the district provide a librarian in every school?
Yes.
I think that's what educational justice looks like.
And so let's ask real quick.
Yeah.
So just like Stacey said with the student-based budgeting, for those who don't know what student-based budgeting is, it's just a budgeting formula that we basically use in CPS where schools are funded based on the projected amount of students that come to school that year. So if students, if there's a low school enrollment, there may not be a librarian. So you only get a librarian if it's like 500 kids for a school. I don't want to give the wrong numbers, but so it's about numbers, and that's not fair. So schools with 300 kids should have the same resources as schools that have 700 students. And so because, as Stacey said, with student-based budgeting, because that's about numbers and the number of students enrolled in the school, some students are left out, which allows or provokes parents to take their children out of a school and put them somewhere, like in a charter school that may have a librarian. So, yes, we do want to change this budgeting formula because it does affect the number of resources and educators are in the building. So that is why a lot of librarians have been pushed out, because it's about the number of student enrollments and that principals have the power to hire who they want to hire. So if they don't want a librarian in school, they feel like they get paid too much, or they feel like it's not important in their school, then they won't pay for it out of the discretionary funds. So we want to go back where CPS will staff that, regardless of how much a teacher may get paid.
Remember, oh, well, it was just one quick point. Remember that we are still taking your questions, and if you have a question, press 9 to get through to an operator. Lillian, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to add on to what Andrew was saying, which is that this is why we have contract demands, not only for librarians, but to return to a system similar to what we had before with quota positions, where schools are provided with a certain number of positions, not a certain amount of money. And this will not only ensure that we have the proper staffing that we need, but it will also allow principals to hire veteran teachers with more experience without having to consider how it will impact their budget.
That's right. Okay, thank you. We're next going to go to Yana, who I believe has a question. Yana,
yes.
Go ahead.
Hi, my question is, I'm a sub, and I want to know how these contracts and everything that you guys are talking about will benefit me.
Mm-hmm. Good. That's a good question. I mean, the first thing you should know is that we're asking for a raise for subs. One of the reasons why we think it's hard to get sub coverage is we think that this doesn't pay subs enough. We feel like that we need more pay. Second thing you need to know is that we're actually demanding more sub coverage. So it's a real problem right now in our district. And when a typical Friday in a South or West Side school, we're talking about 10, if 10 teachers call in, only 4 of those teachers get sub coverage, which means that in a lot of these schools, school is up for grabs. It's very hard to have a functioning education environment with that many people out. So we not only do we need better pay for subs, we need more of them. And so, I think that's good for subs as well. Another thing I want to mention about sub needs is that, like, currently CPS does not have a uniform practice about providing preps for subs. One of the things, for example, that used to be the case is you'd go into a school, you'd get handed a particular teacher's program, and then you'd take that teacher's prep time, so you'd have a chance to eat some food or go to the bathroom, God forbid, if you have to do that, or make a phone call. Now, because they have so many teachers out, principals are trying to cover 3 teachers' positions with 2 subs, which means that they're often scheduling subs every single moment of the day in front of students. And so we have a contract demand which would say we want to restore the right to get prep time as well. Am I leaving anything out here, Lillian? Is there anything I should add?
There's also we're asking also for additional cadre subs, which would, as a substitute teacher, if you could be a cadre sub, that would increase your pay and the number of days that you could work.
That's right.
And also that would just build morale in the school, because you'll be in that school every day. Right. Instead of being a day-to-day sub, you'll be in that building where you can build better relationships with the students, and that's what we want to happen in the schools as well.
Yeah, very good. Okay, thank you for that question. We're going to go to John next, who I believe is a question about paperwork. Are you still there, John?
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear, go ahead.
Hi, I know in the previous contract we had a paperwork clause that I think allowed us to only really have to worry about making sure our lesson plans were turned in, and then if any other paperwork is given to us, the principal had to kind of take something off the table. And from my perception, principals kind of got around that, and some of them never followed it, and a lot of members never even grieved it. I wanted to know, what does the paperwork clause look like in this new contract, or if there is even one?
Sure. Thank you for the question. The paperwork clause in our last contract was the first time we've had that language, And you're right. There are many places where we use that language to force paperwork off our members' plates. The basic mechanism of the language said that if they added something, they had to remove something else. The problem, of course, is that principals do have a lot of ways to get around that. They make language which isn't really as, they make demands, paperwork demands, which pretend to be mandatory, in which they're constantly like adding stuff on the plate. It can be hard to get out of that. So we are in fact trying to strengthen that language in the next contract. And one of the things I'll also add is that in places where we've had a lot of success in this, we've been able to go, a lot of those paperwork demands come from the network, where the network is putting compliance demands on principals, who then in turn are turning around and putting that down on their teachers. And so we've been able to actually get groups of folks to go in, use the network level PPC or their school level PPC, and get paperwork removed. So those are the places where it's been successful, but it hasn't been successful in all places, and it's something we need to keep pushing. We have demands around it.
And let's be clear, the success of the implementation of the contract comes at the local level and implementation of the contract. If we are not signaling that there is an issue with implementation at the very local level, then we won't be able to find a solution to it. The PPC is always the best tool for implementation. Now, if that doesn't work, we obviously can do other things, from grieving it to creating workplace actions to make sure that it is respected. But I cannot tell you enough how many schools I go to and speak to members who are frustrated and who are fatigued but have never filed a grievance, members who have never put it on an agenda for a PPC. We have to take the steps necessary to make our school communities work better, and that starts with our own local level enforcement of the contract.
It's also recommended that, again, through the PPC, when you're given your assignments in August, keep track of them, write them, and the PPC should request that the principal, anything new added to the requirements should go through the PPC. Ask the principal to present new requirements through the PPC, and then you can vet it out and to show, well, no, you're adding this, and if you're adding this, you need to take this off. So if you enact that in August when you first get to school, it's very helpful. And as Stacy said, you need a powerful PPC.
And if you want to know more about the PPC, just go on the CTU Local 1.org website, and it'll be more information about that on how to make sure that you be strong in that.
Thanks. And Lillian, you have something to add.
Yep. And this is Lillian. And I can attest to how strong the PPC can be. I've won a lot of important gains in my schools that I've been at through the PPC, both in terms of paperwork and other issues. But also to answer your question, one of our contract demands around paperwork in particular is we're requesting that if that paperwork reduction doesn't happen to compensate for additional paperwork, that teachers should be paid their instructional rate of pay for the extra time that they have to put in for whatever additional paperwork requests. So if we were to win this contract language, that would again be something we could take to the PPC to either demand that the principals take that extra paperwork off because they're not going to want to pay, or that they pay us for the work that we do.
Thank you. So we're still taking questions. So if you've got a question, dial 9, and we'll try to get to the stack. Also, I want to take a moment and ask you guys another question. Oh, I'll say as I'm getting into this that the answer to the first question, we got about a third of the people on the call right now who said they're planning on coming to the rally. That's great. But about 40% are saying that they're not sure yet. So I want to urge you to get out there.
It's come on
down. Weather's going to be great. There's only like a 30% chance of snow. So it's going to be, it should be good. And we have a rain plan too, actually. So please come down. It's going to be very important. And please press the line and wear your CTU red. That's right.
In fact, we should be wearing red on Fridays. Like, one of the big deals that has to happen is that we have to demonstrate our unity. One of the smaller things that we can do to have a great demonstration of unity and practicing unity is wearing red on Fridays. Yes. And plus, it's a color that looks good on every complexion.
Okay, there you go. Okay. I am going to now I'm going to ask folks a question about some of the kinds of activities that we're doing out in our buildings to about connecting with our fellow CTU members in the current contract fight. So I want you to press 1 on your phone if you'll wear red every Friday and on 522 for the rally. I want you to press 2 on your phone if you'll help to organize in your building on your contract action team. People will know that there should be a team of people who are trying to get the word out about what's going on with their contract fight. And I want you to press 3 on your phone if you'll work with your colleagues to reach out to parents about our rally and contract demands. So again, 1 if you wear red every Friday and on the 522 rally. 2 if you'll help organize in your building on your contract action team. And 3 if you'll work with your colleagues to reach out to parents about our rally and our contract demands. We'll let those results come in. Remember to dial 9 if you've got more questions. And we've got time for them to take another question on the line here. Let's go to Lisa, if she's still there. Lisa, are you on?
Yes, I'm still here.
Great. Go ahead. You have a question.
Yes, I was. I had a question and concern about the residency agreement and if that's even being considered to take off the table in the new contract.
Got it. Yeah, thank you for the question.
So it's not in a collective bargaining agreement, actually. This is state law. State law mandates that city workers live in the city of Chicago. Look, one of the things that the second Mayor Daley understood about the working class is that it had the capacity to secure a city. So what we do in this city as homeowners and as people who spend our money in the city is that we actually sustain it. And so his theory of the case, which has been right so far, is that if you employ a working class and this working class then has to reside in the city, that the city reaps the benefits of it. And in part, our pensions, money for our classrooms come from our family's investment in this city. However, there are many members who feel deeply about having the flexibility to live in spaces other than Chicago. And then there are other, even more sophisticated members who say that, look, let's figure out what a regional tax would look like so Chicago wouldn't lose revenue if we left the city. What I will say is that in order for the Chicago Teachers Union to undertake that mammoth task and switch that up, that would also mean that this has to be something that the House of Delegates supports. So I would encourage all of the teachers who want this to happen to present a resolution in committee or present a resolution to our executive board and allow that debate to occur.
Yeah, thank you. I have to say that's one that I feel kind of ambivalent about personally, because while I do think that teachers have the freedom to live anywhere they want, I also think that there's been something important about having our membership in the city. It's helped our political power in terms of a voting bloc, our influence among the public, because we're not perceived as people who like teach their kids and then go home to the suburbs, but we live in the communities where we teach. So, you know, those two things both weigh on us. And so just to be honest with you, that there's more than one thing going on there. The good news on this on the poll we just took is that there's lots of people who are going to be doing all these things.
Ooh.
So, those are the way those results are coming in. Let's take some more questions. We've got Michael.
Yes, my question is kind of in two parts. The first part has to do with whether or not we need any action in Springfield in order to get leverage for things like class size and also for student-based budgeting. If that's something that we can negotiate without help legislatively in Springfield.
Hey, Michael, this is Stacy, so I'll take this one. So for the past few years, we've been able to get both a repeal of 4.5 and elected representative school board out of the House of Representatives a few times. With overwhelming majorities, in fact, only to be stopped cold in the Senate. You know, for those of you who don't know, there's a very well-known secret that John Cullerton provided a lot of deference to Rahm Emanuel when he was the, well, he still is, but as the mayor of Chicago. John Cullerton indicated yesterday in a few news stories about the elected representative school board bill that he is still willing to give the mayor, now the mayor-elect, Lori Lightfoot, that same deference. What does that mean? So what John, what Michael is asking us is, like, our charter brothers and sisters have been able to win very clear gains on class size caps. They've been able to negotiate about basically everything in their school community. In 1995, the second Mayor Daley went to Springfield with the Republican governor, Republican Speaker of the House, Republican Senate President, and what he did was take our pensions and get full control of that. Another thing that he did was narrow the number of things that we could go on strike for. And the only things that we are actually legally available to go on strike for are wages and benefits. The ability to strike over the calendar, the ability to strike over class size, third-party contracting, all of these things are prohibited. Now, if the Board of Education wants to negotiate over these things, obviously we can, but the Board of Education doesn't want to negotiate over these things. So the very win that we were able to obtain in the 2016 contract with some class size limitations for K, kindergarten, first grade, and second grade was basically pure magic because that wasn't supposed to happen. Now to your question, we are going to have to do a lobby day in Springfield. Now, I don't know how many of you still have personal days left, but I just spoke to our legislative director, Kurt Hilgendorf, and he said that he thinks that especially the Senate side of the General Assembly needs to see red T-shirts, and they need to be able to explain to teachers, to active teachers, to TSRPs, to clinicians, to anyone who goes in the school building and has to endure the filthiness of the school building and why it's okay for John Cullerton to continue to hold on to the bills that we put forth to make our school communities better. They are exposed in this moment. Our charter sisters and brothers have done a yeoman's job with getting class size reductions. And the fact that we, who teach very similar students in the same city with the same challenges, cannot do it, is actually unfair, inequitable, and unequal.
Thank you, Stacey. I'm going to take the next questioner, who's Dawana, and we're going to try to give our answers fairly succinctly because we're approaching the end of our time, so we can try to squeeze in some more questions here. Dawana, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Go ahead. You have a question?
Yes. Yes. I'd like for you to speak a little bit about what you're proposing for special education, because as much as we try, sometimes special education kind of, to me, gets the short end of the stick. Also, if you could speak to case management, because I know that in the last contract we made gains and, you know, principals were supposed to take on case management and APs or teachers so that we could relieve the counselors. But what's happening is they're not doing a very good job, and the students are still suffering. And for those teachers who've taken on case management, of course, we still have to be in the classroom teaching, and it's just overwhelming.
Hi, this is Lillian, and I'm as a special education teacher and a member of the special ed subcommittee in bargaining. I'll try to answer your question. As for case management, our contract proposal is to have a case manager, a separate case manager position in every school, and for those larger schools, maybe even one and a half or two full-time separate case management positions that have no other duties other than case management. As for other special ed proposals, we have a lot of special education proposals. We've already been meeting with CPS on these issues. Our sort of key points are to improve staffing formulas for teachers and PSRPs for special education, ensuring that we have an appropriate continuum of services to address all student needs, and improving conditions for teachers, particularly around co-teaching, making sure we have adequate prep time with our co-teachers so we can plan together, and other, you know, other needs that we have as special education teachers to make sure we can appropriately service our students.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, I just want to underscore that that's a real priority for us. Special education issues are outrageous what CPS is doing and very important. Okay, let's hear from Chrissy, who is at PSRP. Chrissy, can you hear me? What's your question?
Yes, I can. I was wondering what is being done for PSRPs, because we always seem to be left in the background. Job security, raises, anything?
Yeah, I really appreciate the question. I'm going to say a couple things, and then I'm going to let LaShawn come in, because I know this is an issue near and dear to her heart. I mean, the first thing I'll say is that we are asking for PSRPs to get an extra grade for pay in addition to the 5% raise. We're also we have a number of demands about PSRP staffing. We're very concerned that PSRPs are being laid off or converted into CICAs. And so we're trying to win enforceable guarantees about the number of PSRPs in our building. We also have a number of pieces of language that would strengthen job protections for PSRPs in the building. Sean, you want to add to that at all?
Right. In this last contract, we won positions for early childhood to get PSRPs within the kindergarten and second grade for overcrowding. So in this proposal in this contract, we are looking at it, and we are asking that we are demanding that we are put back in the building, that we are in the classrooms, that we are available to assist teachers as well as students. As Jesse spoke about our pay raise, we are also asking for those of us that have degrees to receive compensation for our degrees. As you know, we have to report to ISB, and all that's come down the pike for us. So we are really asking for some things for us, and we're looking to really gain some stuff. And I think you'll be very happy with it once the contract, hopefully that CPS accepts our proposals.
Right. And to making sure that's going to happen, two things. Number one, we definitely need PSRPs on board. Heart and soul of our building, extremely important. They're the core of our army, if you will, and so it's very important to us. I know we did a special call for PSRPs only last week, and so that we hope that's a sign of how
another thing what I need to express on about our PSRPs, when you encounter other people outside doing your job, you need to let the union know. If you have a parent in the office, if you have a parent doing things that a PSRP should be doing, you need to let us know so that we can get fair reps and we can get the people out there to talk to the principals to work that out, because a lot of times they principals will use that to train them to do the very job that you're doing, and then they'll flip it. So what we need to do in order to combat and secure our jobs, we have to be reporting these things that are going on in our buildings.
Yeah, thank you, Sean. And the other thing that we can all do is show up in red at the May 22nd rally, 5 p.m. at the Thompson Center. We're out of time. I want to really say I appreciate everyone for joining us for CTE's live telephone town hall. And we are going to see everyone out there on the 22nd and wherever we need to be in order to win a fair contract. So thank you, everyone, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.